Welcome to episode 10 here at biodefense.com. This is Pandemic Preparedness. And if you haven't heard the entire course, go to biodefense.com right away to get the course. It's freely downloadable MP3 files. You can play them on any device you want. And in this episode, going to be talking about what happens if Ebola is announced in Canada, the United States, or Mexico. What happens if it crosses the Atlantic? In other words, what's that going to set off in terms of actions? And it's going to be quite an event if it takes place. I want you to be fully aware of what's going to happen and to be prepared for it. But first, I want to personally thank you for sharing the news about this course at biodefense.com. Over a million people now have come to the website. The files have been downloaded many hundreds of thousands of times each, the different episodes, different chapters. And I feel really humbled and honored to be able to be a teacher, to help bring you this information, to be able to share this. And I want you to know, too, from a very personal perspective, that being able to share and teach this information also helps me prepare. So as I am sharing this information, I'm also shoring up my own personal preparedness plans. And the reason I mention this is because people have talked to me privately and said, you know, gosh, you sound like you've got everything nailed down and you're all prepared. And we've only just begun. We're not ready. We can't do everything that you talk about. There's no way we can get ready in time and so on. The truth is, and this is what I want to share with you, this very a very personal note. None of us are ever as prepared as we want to be, myself included. And I need to practice these skills that I'm also urging you to practice. I need to shore up my supplies just as I'm urging you to shore up yours. In fact, the next episode in this biodefense course is about how to save the life of a family member or a friend at home if they are turned away from the hospitals, which they will be in a pandemic, and they have to survive at home. How do you support them medically? How do you isolate other family members from that infected person? And to do this, I'll be recommending some particular medical supplies, such as isolation gowns, latex gloves, the foot or shoe protectors, and the hair nets, and even full face respirators. And as I was planning to produce that chapter, episode 11, or at least that's what it's planned to be, I found that I was short on those supplies as well. And so I had to order some more of those myself. In fact, in every chapter, at the same time that I'm sharing information with you, I'm also checking my list and making sure that I have all these things ready as well. And if I'm not ready, then I'm making sure that I increase my preparedness to have them to have those things ready. So this course is really, it's a gift to me as much as it's also a gift to you. You know, you're getting it for free, but I'm also getting a benefit from it by being able to teach this and thereby review myself some of my own preparedness plans at the same time that I'm helping others get prepared as well with the intention of saving lives. And that's what this is all about. My intention with this course has always been, number one, get people the information, the knowledge, the know-how that they need to save their life or to save the life of someone else, a family member, a friend, a patient, and so on. The other intention is to boost the national security of the United States or any other country in which Ebola may strike. A strong nation comes from having a well-informed, well-prepared population. And it's just astonishing to me that we have governments around the world right now which are so invested in this entitlement philosophy that people are supposed to be subjects of the government, that people should depend on the government, that has caused governments to refrain from really telling people to get prepared. So governments are withholding information that people need to save their own lives, and that creates a weak nation. For example, a strong America would come from strong, decentralized local food production, where people were growing home gardens and growing herbal plants themselves, and more local farmers and farmers markets and so on. And yet all these things have been under attack by the government. The result is that farming has become centralized and corporatized, making it very, very dangerous in terms of redundancy or lack of redundancy, actually, and creating vulnerabilities so that the national food supply is more vulnerable to disruptions or even attacks or fuel, lack of fuel. Any kind of a problem now is more likely to result in a food shortage. Whereas if food were more decentralized and people grew more local gardens, then there would be more national food security. So what I'm creating here is a pandemic preparedness national security program is really what this should be called. At least that's my intention. And I believe that if we had a responsible media, a responsible press, they would be teaching this and I wouldn't have to. Or maybe they would ask me to create courses that the public can benefit from. I believe that if our government wanted to really help people prepare, that it would be teaching the exact things that I'm teaching in this course. Sadly, once again, we have a government that is more interested in its own survival than the survival of the citizens. And that's why this is the only place that you can find a course like this. Isn't that astonishing? In fact, the extent of our government's preparedness advice comes down to basically what you find at ready.gov, which is, oh, you should have a 3-day food supply, as if 3 days is enough. And the CDC gives us amazing advice, which basically consists of wash your hands until a vaccine arrives. Bet everything on the vaccine. Don't do anything else, they say. Don't boost your immune system. Don't use antiviral herbs or traditional Chinese medicine. Don't take zinc supplements or selenium. Don't do things to boost your defenses and protection, except just wash your hands and pray for a vaccine. Now, that's pretty much it. And it is extremely irresponsible on their part to deny people the information that could save their lives. So that's the role that I'm pursuing here with this course at biodefense.com. So let's get now really to the meat of this episode, which is really the answer to the question, what would happen if Ebola were announced in North America, Canada, the United States, Mexico, or maybe even Central America? What if it showed up in Panama? What if it showed up in Brazil or Venezuela or Chile? This is a legitimate question for obvious reasons. The CDC is now reportedly, they've got a software model that predicts in a worst-case scenario Ebola spreading to over 500,000 people. I don't know the exact timeline of that. Maybe that's 12 months out. But remember, it was just a few weeks ago that the World Health Organization said, no, it's going to max out at about 20,000 people. Now that number is 500,000, according to the CDC software models. That is a substantial difference. That is 25 times more fatalities than were predicted by the WHO. So, gosh, 500,000 people. If 500,000 people are infected, how does it stop at 500,000? This is my question. If, in other words, if the CDC model is predicting 500,000 people infected, then how does it stop at 500,000 people? Did they just stop the software simulation at that projection and say, well, this is the end? Or are you know what I'm saying? How do they keep it under control once it reaches 500,000? This, no one has been able to explain this. Does it somehow burn out at 500,000? How do they keep it in the continent of Africa? How do they keep it within these countries, Sierra Leone or Guinea or Liberia? This is a very serious question. Now, given that in our world there is so much rapid air travel, people are obviously going from city to city in a matter of just a few hours, from continent to continent, crossing the oceans in a matter of a few hours. How do they prevent this from going from Africa to Morocco or Spain then, and then the UK, France, Germany, Scotland, Ireland? How do they keep it out of the Middle East? How does it stay out of Egypt and Saudi Arabia? And how do they keep it out of Ukraine and Russia or China for that matter? And if it gets into Europe, especially say London, how do you keep it out of the United States given all the air travel between London and New York, for example? Do you shut down all the flights between London and New York? Do you quarantine, in essence, any nation where there are infected people by cutting off all air traffic to that nation? If so, then you're going to have extraordinary economic consequences. And given the incredible fragility of our global economic system, which is, let's face it, a debt pyramid, a house of financial cards that's ready to collapse on its own, any insult to that system, such as cutting off air travel, really runs the risk of having catastrophic economic consequences. In fact, these nations that have already been struck by Ebola infections, which include Sierra Leone and Liberia, are already going to face dire economic consequences, especially since one of them, Sierra Leone, had medical martial law declared. They shut down the entire nation for 3 days. Now, imagine shutting down the entire U.S. economy, let's say, for 3 days. The economic consequences of that would be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, you're shutting down all trucking. You're shutting down all petroleum refineries, fuel deliveries, financial institution transactions. Checks won't clear for the 3 days. You know, if you shut down the economy for 3 days, you run the risk of causing an absolute house of cards, domino effect, economic catastrophe in the United States. So, and the same may be true in London. I'm not as familiar with the finances of London and the UK, but they are no doubt in a very similar debt bubble because all the banking systems are intertwined in much the same way. So you are really facing a scenario where this pandemic viral outbreak causes, or I should say catalyzes, the global economic downfall that is already on the precipice of collapse anyway. It could be that Ebola is just sort of the last straw that breaks the camel's back and causes the whole thing to start to snowball in an implosion. Without Ebola hammering away at the economic situation, the globalists might be able to continue this global economic house of cards for a few more years, perhaps. They can make the debt bubble bigger and bigger and bigger by keeping it propped up. But they can't do it forever. And this pandemic could be something that causes it to implode much, much more quickly than it otherwise would. So that's something to think about. In addition to the economic consequences, though, or in fact, I should say something that's far more important than those, is to think about the social impact of what would happen if Ebola were announced, it were discovered in the wild, in people in America. And when I say in the wild, that's a medical term, meaning it's on the street. Doesn't mean it's out in the desert somewhere in the Sahara. No, it means it's on the street. It's not controlled. So what if 10 patients show up, let's say in Miami, just to pick a random city. I'm not saying Miami, that this is going to happen in Miami, but it's just a random city. Let's say 10 patients show up in a hospital in Miami and they have these symptoms, and it turns out they all have Ebola. Well, for them to be symptomatic, they must have been carrying Ebola from anywhere from 2 to 21 days, because that is the incubation period of the disease, according to the CDC. So up to 3 weeks, someone can be carrying it and potentially transmitting it without even knowing that they have it. So what happens then? You get 10 people showing up in the hospital in Miami. Immediately, everybody in the medical community who knows anything about infectious disease realizes that for every one person in the hospital, there might be 2, 5, 10, or even 20 more people on the street who have already been infected. And this is the point I really want you to understand. For every one person in the hospital that shows up, there could be, let's just say, 10 more people who are already infected on the street. If this happens in a city like Miami, it's already uncontrollable. What do you do? Do you shut off? Do you quarantine Miami? Give me a break. They can't even stop the drug smugglers from getting in and out all day long, 24/7. How are they going to shut down a city like Miami and quarantine it? It's impossible. As a result, it will spread. It will spread from any such city where it is detected. Now, if the mainstream media then reports the truth on this, which is questionable, they might try to stage a cover-up and just say, maybe the CDC orders the media, oh, we don't want to cause a panic, they might say. Maybe the White House calls the president of CNN, says, no, we're supposed to say this is all just people who have the sniffles. Never mind the fact that they're all convulsing and flinging blood all over the emergency rooms. Nah, they just have a common cold or whatever. Maybe they'll come up with a cover story and try to deny it, which would be incredibly stupid, of course, because that would cause infections to spread more quickly. But you never know. Between the government and the media, any kind of deception is possible. But if they told the truth and they said, hey, whoa, Ebola has now been verified in 10 patients, or maybe it's even just 2 patients, in Miami Hospital, what do you think would happen from that point? This is the point of this chapter of the biodefense course. To answer this question, I want you to think back to March of the year 2011. There was a significant world event, a major catastrophe and historical catastrophe that took place in March of 2011. Do you know what it was? It was the nuclear meltdown of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility on the coast of Japan. And there are several important things to realize about what happened there. Number one, even though nuclear fuel meltdowns took place, all of us at the alternative media who were talking about the meltdowns, we were called conspiracy theorists, and the official story of the mainstream media was that there was not a meltdown. So this was a denial, a deliberate denial that took place, and it went on for a very long time. It's only now, in retrospect, that the Western media will even admit that fuel rods actually melted down, that there was a nuclear fuel meltdown. At the time, it was considered a conspiracy theory. Yeah, I know it seems strange, but if you actually go back to 2011, that is exactly what was going on. We were being called conspiracy theorists. And so, oh, there was no meltdown, just a small amount of radiation was released, so on and so forth. Complete media lies. But the second and far more important thing that took place right after this Fukushima meltdown was that everybody in the world at the same time realized that they needed to protect themselves against this release of deadly radiation. And at the time, most people had some awareness of the ability of potassium iodide to protect the thyroid gland from the radioactive isotope of iodine, which is iodine-131. Now, what's fascinating about this is that all over the world, all at the same time, everybody suddenly wanted to buy every source of iodine that they could get their hands on. They bought every form of iodine, including potassium iodide. You know, the KI pills is what they're called. They bought also nascent iodine, elemental iodine, and basically iodine tinctures, any kind of a form of iodine that they could get their hands on, because everybody wanted to take iodine all of a sudden. Which is, from one perspective, it's great because iodine can help prevent different types of cancers, breast cancer and prostate cancer. And iodine has a lot of great health benefits, and most people are deficient in it. So all of a sudden, we had everybody in the world actually taking a beneficial trace mineral that they were probably lacking. So that's the benefit of it. But the shocking part of this was that, of course, immediately every retailer of iodine ran out of the product. Couldn't keep it in stock. Couldn't even ship it quickly enough. I remember at that time, there were people who were selling iodine on eBay. They were selling actually potassium iodide pills for $600 that would normally be sold for about 10 bucks. So there was a lot of profiteering going on, and obviously demand far outstripped supply, and all of a sudden prices went through the roof. Now, just to let you know, historically, our store at the Natural News Store, we sold nascent iodine at the time, and we did not price gouge. We did not change the price at all. We simply sold it for the price that we had always sold it for until we ran out, and then it was just gone. So we didn't engage in price gouging because I think that's unethical personally. But we were also unable to supply very much to very many people because it wasn't an item that we had stockpiled. You know, who could have anticipated the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant going into a sudden meltdown following a tidal wave, following an earthquake? So I mean, although you can predict these things are going to happen eventually, it's really hard to know when they're going to happen, and it's not profitable to, say, stockpile in a warehouse somewhere, you know, $5 million worth of iodine bottles, hoping that someone wants to buy them one day. That's just not a business model that works. So no one had these iodine products stockpiled. And it also turns out that iodine is very, very difficult to manufacture because it's hard to source the raw iodine material because of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, restricting the importation of iodine because, believe it or not, iodine is one of the ingredients that druggies use to manufacture meth. So I don't know if you've ever seen any of these documentaries. I've seen some documentaries that show people making meth with like what they call a shake and bake method, using a soda bottle and parts from batteries and parts from liquid Drano and iodine and something else. I don't know what all the ingredients were, but I mean, just to imagine that anyone would, what do they do? Do they snort it? Do they shoot it up? I don't even know. But that anyone would take this is astonishing. And even more, the fact that it would then interfere with the iodine importation, which is crucial for protection against nuclear catastrophes, is even more astonishing. So as a result of the war on drugs and the DEA and the shake-and-bake meth makers, the iodine was in massively short supply. People couldn't get the iodine that they desperately needed following the nuclear catastrophe. And as a result, prices spiked through the roof from $10 to $600. Now, what does this tell you? Number one, the big lesson from this should be that you should stock up on the stuff you need before you need it. So in the prepping community, these are called preps. People talk about it. They say, oh, I've got my preps stored in the garage, or I've got my preps at an offsite storage location, or I need more preps. I'm running short on my preps. So this is the common term that's used in the prepping industry. So I'll go ahead and use that term. But when it comes to all your preps, by the time that you realize you desperately need your preps, everybody else does too, which means nobody's going to be able to get those preps because all those preps are already sold out everywhere, meaning the preps are going to be skyrocketing in price. So you're going to have to pay out big to get those same preps that you could get on the cheap if you had been ahead of the masses. Make sense? Now, I know you know this, and I know this is common sense. And yet, so many of us, including myself to some extent, we are still behind on our preps. Just like I said at the beginning of this episode, I didn't have the isolation gowns that I would probably need in the pandemic. I still need some more plastic sheeting, you know, to build kind of like a makeshift isolation room. I'm probably a little bit short on some of the duct tape that I need to assemble a makeshift isolation room. I don't know if I've got enough bleach. I mean, even these questions are running through my mind at the same time that I'm even teaching this material. So you should be going through your mind throughout this entire course, all the chapters, all the episodes here. Everything that you think you need, you should probably make a list and make this your high priority list, and realize that something that costs 10 bucks today might cost $600 in a crisis. And when will that crisis begin? It will begin the day that they announce Ebola is in the hospital in Miami. That's the day it begins. On that day, every isolation gown sold on Amazon.com will be sold out. Every pair of latex gloves that's available in the entire nation will be sold out probably within 72 hours. Every N95 mask will be gone within a matter of a couple of days, just like what happened during the bird flu pandemic, or the hoax, the pandemic hoax that the CDC hyped up. Every N95 mask was sold out. You couldn't find them anymore. The only way to get these preps is to get them ahead of time. And it turns out that not only does that save you a tremendous amount of money because you're getting them at the normal everyday price, but if you so desire, you could also sell some of your supplies to someone else who needs them in the middle of a crisis. And that's your business. I'm not going to get into your business as a free market. Buy and sell whatever you want. But I'm not in that business. I'm not speculating on supplies based on a pandemic. But there'll be a lot of people who will. And that is a way that some people will help prepare their neighbors or their friends or family members or whatever the case may be. They'll buy more than they need, and then they'll sell some to their neighbors, or they'll sell some to a family member. And there'll be a few people out there who are, of course, doing this massive price gouging on eBay, which is, again, I think unethical, but that's the free market. That's what will happen. I remember when I was living in Ecuador, like a lot of South American countries, they're based on a socialist model where the government subsidizes the key consumption items that the population needs, such as fuel, or cooking fuel, or gasoline, or rice, or bread, or milk, or butter, or whatever. And this is done by socialist countries in order to make the population artificially happier by tricking the population into thinking that things are more affordable than they really are. Now, everywhere that you have the government subsidizing something, what you do is you create an artificial price suppression where the item being subsidized now exists at a below free market value, which means that you instantly create a black market of smugglers who come into the country to buy that subsidized thing there, and then they exit the country to go sell that item at a profit in a neighboring country where it is being sold at actual market value. And in Ecuador, gasoline was one of the things that was being heavily subsidized by the government. Rafael Correa was the president. I think he's still the president, actually. And Correa, even though he's an economist who was trained, I think he went to the University of Illinois, I think, in America, he is still, like nearly all South American leaders, he is still a rampant, raging socialist. And so he had all these subsidies on gasoline. Well, it didn't take long before there was a massive smuggling operation of people smuggling fuel out of Ecuador into neighboring nations. And one of the ways that this was done was by, at one point, the border crosses a gorge, a very large gorge with a bridge crossing it, you know, with a road on top of the bridge. And the smugglers would be on opposite sides of the bridge. There would be a sending party on the Ecuador side and then a receiving party on the other side, another nation, Peru, let's say. And they would have large containers of gasoline suspended by a long rope tied to the underside of the bridge like a giant pendulum. And then they would let go of the fuel on the Ecuador side, and the fuel would swing like a giant pendulum all the way over to the other side, where they would catch it and unload it there. So Ecuador became a nation where gasoline was exported via pendulums. And why would smugglers go to this incredible effort? Because the price difference made them a lot of money, a lot of money. There was instantly a black market for selling fuel, which then, of course, Correa declared to be, you know, an illegal criminal operation, terrorist operation, perhaps. Who knows what he declared. They started a permitting process to put gasoline in containers. But I say all of that not to amuse you with Ecuador's gasoline pendulum export machinery, but rather in the hopes that you will understand that wherever there is high consumer demand and a shortage of supply or an artificial subsidy, you're going to have black markets cropping up everywhere. And in a pandemic, you're going to have black market forces, which I don't even like the phrase black market, by the way. It should just be sort of underground economy, I think, maybe is a better phrase. But or maybe we should say a non-official economy. The underground economy will flourish. And in fact, as I'm recording this, there's already been an underground economy cropping up in the trade of the blood of Ebola survivors. Yeah, I think the CDC even put out a warning about this a few days ago. So if you think about it, people who survive Ebola, they have blood that carries the antibodies that their body built, that their immune system created, that saved their life from the Ebola infection. Does that blood have some value? Absolutely. Many people believe that that blood, if it's transfused into someone else's body, might help them overcome Ebola. I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying that that's what some people believe. Other people are wanting to buy it for research purposes, you know, universities, governments, maybe terrorists, who knows. This blood has a market value, and some people are now apparently offering their blood for sale, saying that they survived Ebola. Pretty wild, huh? But that just goes to show you that these black markets will show up very, very quickly. So back to the scenario that I mentioned, if 10 people are announced, or even one person, in the Miami hospital, we found today one person who has been diagnosed with Ebola. It's here, let's say, the media announces. Then you're going to have everything selling out, just like I mentioned, all the quarantine supplies, all of the isolation gowns, the latex gloves, the hand sanitizers, but also all the other preparedness supplies. Ammunition is going to be sold out nationwide. Water filters, colloidal silver. You won't be able to find a vial of colloidal silver anywhere in the country at that point. Believe me, every single colloidal silver product, or sometimes it's called nano silver, will be totally sold out everywhere. You won't be able to find it. That'll be like the iodine was with the Fukushima catastrophe. And you're going to have everything is going to be sold out. All the preparedness supplies, the 30-day food supplies, you know, the storable food, everything you can imagine. Flashlights, batteries, AR-15s will be gone off the shelves again, and then the prices will skyrocket again, right like they did after the Sandy Hook shooting in, what was that, December of 2012, was it? Yeah, December 2012. So you need to think about this in advance, or at least that's what I'm urging you to do. That's the whole point of this. If that day comes that they announce this pandemic is in America, it's going to spread the fear across the population faster than it spreads the virus. The fear will sweep through the consciousness at the speed of Fox News and CNN. So the fear will take hold. The fear will be translated into urgent, desperate preparedness purchases by people who have, by and large, procrastinated all their preparedness plans, or in most cases, they never even thought about this stuff. Because most people, let's face it, are not preppers. Most people are not preppers. They become preppers at the last minute when they feel like they need to in order to survive. Everybody has the potential to be a prepper, but most people are putting it off until they absolutely desperately need to be a prepper. And so that's what will cause the massive panic, the massive shortages of all the supplies that people will all want all at the same time. So right now, in fact, I purchased some of these just the other day. You can go on Amazon.com, which is a retailer that I kind of love and hate both. I love to buy things on Amazon with their Prime shipping. I hate the fact that some of their stuff is counterfeit when it comes to herbs. But, you know, they do a great job delivering a lot of really high-quality products. And one of the things that you can buy on there is a Tyvek bodysuit with a hood. Now, Tyvek is, of course, made by DuPont, which is another corporation that I love and hate. I hate the fact that DuPont is into selling genetically modified organisms, but I love the fact that DuPont has some amazing materials like Tyvek, which is the brand name for their special tear-resistant material. I don't even know what it's made out of, but it's amazing stuff. And so you can walk around in a Tyvek bodysuit, a full suit of Tyvek with a hood. And if you put on booties with it and you put on some latex gloves and you put on a full face respirator, you're basically in a biohazard hazmat suit. And as of right now, you can buy that Tyvek suit on Amazon.com for $7. Yep, $7 for a Tyvek suit. Now, why might you need a Tyvek suit? Well, maybe one of your family members comes home and they've been diagnosed with Ebola. And you have to set up an isolation room for them. And you have to take care of them. You have to bring them food, bring them water, and, you know, try to take care of them, save their lives. are you going to just walk in there in a short sleeve shirt and a pair of flip flops? No, you're going to put on a Tyvek suit. You know, you're going to put on a full face respirator. You're going to basically treat that person as a biohazard because they are, they're infectious. So you're going to try to support them, but you don't want to infect yourself. You need a Tyvek suit. Today, $7. After the infection is announced in Miami, that suit will probably be sold on Amazon.com for $100, or maybe even $200. Somebody's going to be price gouging, profiteering. Somebody's going to have probably stored a warehouse of 100,000 Tyvek suits, and they're going to be selling them on eBay for $100 a pop. And they'll probably get $100 a pop because people will be desperate. Again, if this happens, and we're all hoping and praying that it doesn't happen. I hope that's clear in all of this. My hope is that there is no infection in Miami or anywhere. I mean, I hope that it ends in Africa. I don't want to see anybody suffering or hurting from this. But the truth is that this is going to be very difficult for modern medical technology to stop, because medical technology is so greed-driven and so monopolistic and so close-minded that they won't even look at the antiviral potential of medicinal herbs, traditional Chinese medicine, colloidal silver, all these other natural medicines. So because of that, they're putting their full faith in just vaccines and drugs. And what if those vaccines and drugs don't work? Then we have a global pandemic, and then we might lose 1 billion people, potentially, on the planet. And of course, if that happens, you won't be able to buy a Tyvek suit. You won't be able to buy a full face respirator. You won't be able to buy any of these things that I've already mentioned, including the colloidal silver. Now, some people will ask, well, wait a minute. Why can't these manufacturers just make more? Why can't they just crank up and you know, crank up the Tyvek suit factories, make more? The answer is found in understanding how manufacturing really works. And the best way to answer this is really to explain the situation that happened after the Sandy Hook shooting of December 2012. Immediately following that shooting, and by the way, this is not, I'm not going to debate the Second Amendment here. I'm just using this as a manufacturing example. But immediately following that shooting, there was a very aggressive push by Obama and Eric Holder and people on the left of the political spectrum to outlaw all firearms in America. And their argument was that since this one school shooting happened, then everyone should be stripped of their constitutional rights. That was their argument, and they believed it. So immediately, everybody who ever wanted to own a firearm realized that they were going to have to buy it now, or they may never be able to buy it for the rest of their life. So they went out and bought an unbelievably huge number of rifles, shotguns, handguns, every kind of firearm that you can possibly imagine. The orders were truly historical, record-breaking. From December 2012 through the next 12 months, all the way through December of 2013, the prices of, for example, AR-15s went up from $600 to over $2,000, sometimes even $3,000. For basic AR-15. Prices of handguns doubled or tripled, sometimes quadrupled. Auctions were set up online for people to purchase firearms, and sometimes they went for 400, even 500% more than usual. And by the way, you can't just purchase a gun online. It has to be sent to an FFL dealer, and then you have to go through an FBI background check and all that. So I'm not saying you can just buy a revolver on Amazon or something. You still had to follow the law. Nevertheless, all these guns are being sold out across the board. To make a rifle, you have to have a certain critical mass of equipment. And this equipment is machine tooling equipment, which is basically very, very high-end, very expensive, multi-million dollar CNC machining equipment, where you can machine metal parts using very precise, robotically controlled CAD operated 3D design software, basically 3D modeling software that takes a block of, let's say, aluminum and machines out of it a firearm receiver, for example, just as an example. And this is a very precise machining type of operation, and the machine that does it is a multi-million dollar machine. Now, this machine has a certain amount of output. And LaRue Tactical, just like every other firearms manufacturer in the country, had a certain amount of capacity set up that was based on the amount of ongoing demand that they would expect to see during normal routine sales of their firearms. And so when that shooting happened in December of 2012, and all of a sudden there was this massive spike of 1,000% increased demand in firearms, none of the firearms manufacturers had the machinery to keep up with that demand. And a lot of people ask, well, why didn't they just buy more machinery? And this is the same question of, why can't they just make more Tyvek body suits? Why can't they just crank it up? The answer is, the payoff time on this machinery is maybe 10 years. These machines are multi-million dollar machines. It's an investment. It is a capital investment made by a company to increase a long-term manufacturing capacity. And it might take 6 months to get the machine in and get it up and running and calibrated and get somebody trained on it to open up another manufacturing line. And then you have to have an expanded building to host the new machine and the new manufacturing line. And a lot of times these machines don't just work by themselves. You got to have another machine before it and another machine after it. And then you have to have personnel trained on those machines too. So you can't just like, it's not like throwing machines at an assembly line. You have to set up a whole new facility, buildings, manpower, knowledge, training, safety training, machinery, infrastructure. All those machines need electricity. They need hydraulic fluid. They need water. They need waste drains. They need oil filtration. All of these infrastructure questions go into putting together a new assembly line. And for what? For a one-time surge in sales that may never be repeated? No way. So LaRue Tactical did not just expand their production lines to meet that new 1,000% increase in demand, because that would be foolish. If they overexpanded and then sales dropped back to normal routine levels, then they would be burdened with too much debt and not enough output to create the revenues to cover the capital investment that it takes to put that machinery in place. So if there's an intelligent business owner running the firearms manufacturer or the DuPont Tyvek bodysuit manufacturing line, or whatever the case may be, a storable food production line, if they're smart business people, they are never going to rapidly expand production to meet a short-term surge in demand. It doesn't make any business sense to do that. And in fact, it represents a very extreme financial risk to try to meet a short-term need with a very long-term burden of a massive capital investment. You don't make Tyvek suits just by magic. There is a process. The process involves machinery. The machinery needs training, and it needs infrastructure, electrical power, and so on. And a lot of times these are three-phase machines. You know, they need 220, 230 volt, three-phase electrical requirements. It's not an easy thing to get. It's not just running an extension cord and plugging these things in. So this idea, a lot of people who let's say, aren't familiar with manufacturing, they might think, well, you know, how come they can't just make more colloidal silver? How come they can't just make more iodine or make more Tyvek suits or make more bullets? Or butter, or whatever the case may be. The answer is, these companies can't just magically expand these production lines. And so the shortages cannot be met in the short term. That's really what I'm trying to explain. The shortages that are caused by massive panic and desperation among consumers can never be met by short-term production increases taken on by manufacturers. It just doesn't work that way. Manufacturing takes a lot of time to ramp up, and it takes a solid business decision to spread out the capital investment across an expectation of future production and future demand by consumers in order to create the revenue streams to cover that capital investment. This is also why we, even in our own store, the Natural News Store, if there's some kind of a panic of some kind and there's a run on some specific product that we happen to sell, it'll be sold out, and there's not much we can do about it either. We can't just magically overnight buy a new building and set up a new production line and get new raw materials. It just doesn't happen overnight. Now, the one institution in our society that has stockpiled almost everything that they're going to need is the government. The government has done more stockpiling than anybody. And so I always find it funny in the mainstream media when they do some story about some, oh, crazy survivalist. Oh, my God, he had 5,000 pounds of food and 100,000 rounds of AR-15 ammo. He's crazy. You know, that meanwhile, the government down the street has freaking underground bunker cities with massive, like, 50 miles of caves. They've got billions of rounds of ammo stockpiled and, you know, underground entire economies. They could survive 10 years in a massive nuclear strike or a meteor strike or something. You know, the government's prepared more than any survivalist by far. And yet the mainstream media never calls them out as being crazy or kooky. But the government's got bullets, billions of bullets. The government has medical supplies. The government has weaponry, vehicles. The government's got food stored like crazy. It's a whole network of caves in Missouri where they do massive underground storage. And I mean, there's miles, literally miles of underground caves. And so they are going to have the supplies that they need to survive. My question to you is, will you have the supplies that you need to survive? And survival isn't, of course, just about stuff. In fact, most of what you need to survive needs to exist between your two ears. You need to have an attitude of survival. You need to have know-how. You need to have hands-on skills to be able to build yourself a shelter out in the woods if you have to, or start a fire using nothing but sticks and some paracord. You know, make yourself a fire saw. You need to have the ability to collect water, to find food, to defend yourself. You need to have all these other skills, but it sure is handy to have stuff, especially if you're planning on staying put. If you're planning on surviving a pandemic outbreak in your home, your apartment, your ranch, then it's great to have a lot of supplies there that can help protect you from that pandemic virus, you know, the medical supplies. It's great to have personal protection and defensive supplies, such as a firearm wherever it's legal. It's great to have sources of light and sources of heat. A nice fire-starting device like a blast match is a really great item to have. You better have some good camping knives. I mean, some real outdoor woodsman type of knives, because the knife is the single most utilitarian tool that you can probably have in any kind of survival kit. You better have backup batteries for your flashlights and your radios. You better have sanitation liquids, iodine or bleach or sanitizing wipes, you know, all these things. It's good to have them. And if you want them, you need to get them before everybody else realizes that they need them too. And so what should you get on this list? Well, I'm not going to give you a list. I'm covering some of it in each episode here on biodefense.com, but I can't give you your list. Actually, it depends on your particular needs. What's your medical status? What's your fitness status? Where do you live? Do you live in a desert? Do you live in a city? Do you live in a swamp? Where do you live? Are you out in the country somewhere? Only you can really create your list of what you need. I can just give you the basic categories. And that's really my goal in this, is to give you reminders so that you can create your list, get the things that you need ahead of time. But most of all, in this chapter, I just wanted to urge you, think about what happens if and when Ebola is announced in your country. What will happen? It will set off a massive spark, a almost panic wave of purchasing of the very supplies that you too will realize you should have had before then. So get on top of it now, and you'll save yourself from having to panic, and you'll save yourself a small fortune too, because everything is much cheaper and much more affordable now than it will be after the panic and after you have to pay black market prices or underground market prices for these goods on eBay. Thanks for listening. Please share this audio. My name is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. I'm the editor of naturalnews.com and the creator of biodefense.com.